Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast, episode 183. I'm Steve Smith, along with Ivan Oseretz, and already on the line, Andres Barbosa. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
What's up, guys? How are you? Good to be back.
We're going to talk tennis. We're going to go to the Australian Open. It took place a couple weeks ago. How's it go? We're a dollar short and a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
Day late and a dollar short. But here are a couple things.
Jessica, catch up on sleep.
What's that?
We had to catch up on our sleep after waking up at 4 a.m. to watch matches.
Yeah, the Happy Slam. I think if you're there, it's a Happy Slam. But if you're on this side of the globe, you're looking at the jet lag.
Yeah, Sleepy Slam on this side.
Sleepy, that's a good sleepy. Jet lag. You definitely have the night shift. Jessica Pegula is looking for a new coach, possibly. That's in the news.
Yeah, I can't believe it. David Witt.
Well, congratulations to David Witt. I mean, obviously, they had a great run, as people would say. I think I'll send her my resume. She's from upstate New York. And I'm not kidding. I do think that I could help her out. And I could help out whoever she hires. Or say confidence on three. One, two, three.
Confidence.
Tell us about Saudi Arabia. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I just saw that basically... I'm not sure if it's in October, but it's almost the, like they're bringing back the Grand Slam Cup from like the early 90s, where I think they're each getting $1.5 million as an appearance fee, and then the winner gets $6 million.
Whoa.
Grand Slam Cup was it 1990 that it started, and McEnroe complained about it when it first came out. Said it was as obscene as a gold toilet in one's house.
With, Peter Korda won that. It was the largest purse when he won that. And people go to our course, Tennis Intelligence Applied. The late bloomer, Orlean Stanoychev, was hired by Peter as a sparring partner after he won that. The Germans...
I only remember the match where Brad Gilbert played David Wheaton. I don't know if that was a year after, but that was like one of the best tennis matches ever because they almost came to blows. Or they might have come to blows on a changeover. It was great.
But didn't Wheaton win that? It was they only had it for a couple of years.
I want to say Gilbert won it, but it might, maybe Wheaton won it another year. I have to look now.
I don't know how many times they ran the Grand Slam Cup, but obviously the four countries, obviously starting in Australia, and then going to France, and then going to England, and then coming to the U.S. They have a stronghold. They, unlike golf, some of the majors in golf, it switches venues. Remember, Tyriac wanted to have the majors not always be in the same place. But Saudi Arabia, $6 million to the winner. And how about, is there something going on with the women as well? If the ATP is doing that, I shouldn't say the ATP if the six individuals selected.
Yeah, that I haven't seen yet. I'm here looking online, and I see. Looks like there was 9-10 editions of the Grand Slam Cup. Looks like Sampras won the initial one, beating Gilbert in the final, and then the year after, Wheaton won it, beating Chang in the final. So I don't know what year was the infamous Gilbert Wheaton dust up, but and Korda won it in '93.
Well, we're going to be able to find it on YouTube. Anybody who wants to just push a few buttons and be able to find that.
I'm on it, Chief.
Tell us about your thoughts on the fans coming in. They don't have to wait two games now.
I mean, it's going to take some getting used to, I'm imagining, but I guess it's different at different events, I would imagine. Like I was watching yesterday on TV, the Dallas Open. I mean, if fans were to move from behind the players, a little bit more eye level than it is at the Australian Open. I think you can, it's something getting used to, but it seemed like the players adjusted relatively quickly at the slams. But I mean, at least in the Dallas Open, it looks like it'd be a little bit more of a disruption. I think it's great. I mean, we're the only sport that forces someone to sit out there for possibly 15, 20 minutes, Maybe some judgment needs to be used, but I mean, I think I like it. I like that rule.
Yvonne, you spent a lot of time at Indian Wells. Did you ever experience that? I know I've been waiting to do sad. And yeah, 15, 20 minutes, it could be even longer, two games.
Yeah, Indian Wells, if you are unlucky and you want to see a match and it's the set just started, they close like these plastic chains in front of you, and you got to wait three games, not just two games, because they don't let you in on the after the first game, and it can last up to 20 minutes, like you said, Steven. I feel like it's more of a disruption from the umpire, really, because I mean I've been going to the Indian Wells tournament for quite a number of years, and really the only time that the players walk in and it's a disruption is when the umpire calls out, please everyone seated. Like when the umpire makes it known to, okay, people are walking around, then everybody looks around and there's a commotion. Whereas I can't quite remember a time where I'd be watching a match and players are like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, players are, walking behind. Of course it happens, but it's like, I feel like it's not that as big of a deal as most people think, in my opinion, from what I've seen.
I one time had the job of holding the people back. It was a small tournament in the 70s. Boca West, Bill Reard, Jimmy Connors' agent. Jimmy O'Brien was in charge. And I had that one job. But the best job I had was to make sure no one sat in these four seats. We're really right down where the players were. It was Jimmy Connors and Carl Myler, a German player. I remember Carl Myler, he played one Gullickson and lost, and then started playing the other Gullickson. So I think he played the righty first, the late Tim. And then he's playing Tom, and he didn't realize there was two of them. He goes, this guy's so good. Last 2 weeks ago, he beat me right-handed. Now he's beating me left-handed. But hearing Jimmy talk to Carl Myler, so that comes to my mind. But you have a pretty good seat if you're the one telling people, sorry, you can't sit down right now.
No. At least at Indian Wells, I wouldn't say.
No, the person standing there, yeah, who's saying he can't come in, you just turn and you just watch while they wait.
Yeah, but I can't, just the experiences that I had from Indian Wells, at least the stadium courts, 2, 3, 4, 5, the ones that are like big and metal, the ones that are most common entrances, they actually let you go in from the back down the middle. And so they made a little hole, and then the people that are holding them back are standing on the inside, and it's tough to see. I mean, there are people sitting there. I mean, I don't know if it's like that at most tournaments, but I wanted to comment on how some players actually, they couldn't care less if people are walking around. First person that comes to mind is Medvedev, who we'll talk about more here, but you can see at the final or most matches, people walking around and he does not care. He just starts serving whenever he's ready and the opponent's ready, which is amazing to me.
With here's something I know a little about. Was on the phone today with a college coach, and I don't think anybody knows really much. It's kind of the question mark of the college scene is NIL, name, image, and likeness. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I think some college players, they're going to make more in pro. They're going to make more money as a college player than they will as a pro tennis player.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of it. I mean, I think in terms of like college football, it's just going to, I mean, kind of, it's kind of like coaching in tennis, where basically now it's allowed. I kind of liked it a little bit more when it was, you had to kind of like sneak it in there. Your coaching tip, it's kind of like, I think the same way in college football, at least, they've always been getting money. They've always been getting cars. They've always been getting something. It's just, were they getting caught? So I'm actually more bothered by the transfer portal than I am the NIL, but
what are your thoughts on the transfer? What are your thoughts on the transfer portal?
I mean, I think it's tough in some instances if you're a coach. I mean, it's like literally, kid has a bad day, a player has a bad week or bad this and that, and then they can just quit the team and move on elsewhere. So I kind of wish it could be at least a 1 year commitment instead of just being able to get up and go. But yeah, so it's a brave new world right now when it comes to college athletics. So it'll be interesting.
I know some college coaches they're being told they have to raise their own money for the NIL, And some, it's like, just take it out of this wheelbarrow filled with gold. The transfer portal for our listeners, you know, a coach reprimands a player and, you know, young 18-year-old freshman goes back to the dorm and they just push a few buttons and then everybody knows they want to transfer. Deion Sanders, the football coach at Colorado, he said, no, I'm not going to risk recruits, picking high school recruits. I'm just going to the transfer portal. Yeah, it's a lot of change with that.
He couldn't wait till Nick Saban was a day into retirement before he tried to invite every Alabama player to come to Colorado.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to be interviewed. Have they replaced Nick Saban yet?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure, but I'm sure a lot of the players are going to be leaving.
Well, coaches stick a little bit longer with the football program. How about the Danish kid? Becker's no longer with him?
Yeah, Holger Rune basically got rid of Severin Luthi and Boris Becker.
And then is he back? He's back with Patrick Maniguulu.
I'm assuming he's still with the coach that developed him as a kid. Was it Lars Christensen, I believe his name is? But, yeah, they haven't announced anything, so I'm assuming that guy's always been on board.
And he's one of the six that is going to be in the event in Saudi Arabia?
As of right now, that's the guy that's the six.
And it's $6 million to the winner. What's that?
Correct. And it does look like Alabama has hired a new football coach. They got the coach from the Washington Huskies.
Okay. I didn't submit my resume.
Andres, what's the format for that new tournament with those six players? Do you know? I didn't catch that.
I don't know. I'm assuming it's going to be some sort of a round robin. I don't know. Maybe two groups of three. They haven't really mentioned it. All that I saw was that it was the winner of the event would get $6 million. But each player was getting an appearance fee of $1.5 million.
So it's kind of like the World Tour Finals just in the beginning of the year and not with the best players, just who they pick or maybe major.
No, I think this is going to be at the end of the year as well. It's going to be in October, I believe.
Oh, wow. So it's not soon. It's at the end of the year. Wow. Interesting.
Current events. We're sitting way up high in Section F. People are telling us to just go buy a hot dog, but what about Simona Halep? Any thoughts on that? Any updates on that?
No, I saw that she was going to go in front of the tribunal to see if she can get her 4-year ban lifted, but I haven't heard anything else.
Well, Patrick
Mortigolo.
Not Maniguulu, Patrick.
Mortigolo.
He stepped forward and said that his crew, so he was taking blame that his crew, the substance that they used was contaminated. And I certainly thought that would help in the appeal. But again, we're not insiders on this. There's other podcasts, the tennis podcast. I think they do this daily and way out of our line. But why we're doing this is I read that Joe Rogan's just signed with $250 for Spotify and
$250 million.
$250. What did I say?
$250.
$250. $250. I think we could get somebody to give us $250. Yeah, that's. Thank you for being here, Yvonne. $250 million. How about pickleball? Speaking of millions of dollars, what are your thoughts on pickleball?
I watched it.
What are they calling it? The pickle slam, or what is that?
Pickleball slam. I mean, I'm a sucker for anything John McEnroe is involved in. So I enjoy all his antics on a pickleball court. He literally looks like he doesn't know the rules. He picked it up the week before, and he's just so entertaining.
Pickleball, you ask. I think Yvonne's heard this. Maybe you haven't. Where'd the name pickleball come from? Pickle.
Yeah, I've heard it. Andres, do you know?
Is it
the name of someone's pet?
Yes, exactly. People buy a house and the house had a badminton court. It was not kept up and, you know, grass growing up through the concrete. And my understanding is they took two buckets, they put a broom, that was the net, and they had ping pong paddles, and they actually had a wiffle ball. And they started knocking the ball back and forth, and their dog, Pickle, really liked it. And that's where we got pickleball. But as you know, I'm promoting pickleball. It's here to stay. You know, like squash, they're not taking over tennis courts. Racquetball, badminton, they're not taking over tennis courts. But they are in tennis. But we need to teach tennis players well and say, go play pickleball and win. It's like in Rocky II when Adrian said, just win, Rocky. Just win. No, you can't beat them. Join them.
We lost Creed in the last week. He passed away.
Really?
Who did?
I'm not the Rocky expert that Steve is, but Apollo Creed was number three. Passed away.
Yeah, I just looked it up. Carl Weathers died at 76. Beloved actor for his role as Apollo Creed in the Rocky franchise passed away.
Oh. 76. That movie was made in 1976.
Ruined Steve's evening now with this.
Very, very good athlete. I believe he played football in the CFL, the Canadian Football League. Oh, he did a great job. 76. Whew. Steve Campbell said, well, if you think of your life as the age of a tennis court, and to make it to 78. So if someone's 17 years old, they're not even to the first service line. You start on the baseline at birth. But yeah, so anyway, 76, that's sad.
Start at the service line at birth?
No, you start at the baseline, and then for every year. So you get to,
there you go, there you
when
go.
You're 39, you're still on the one side of the net. So you get to be 60, you're all the way to the far service line. You know, if some people live a long time. You go fence to fence, you'd be 120. With doubles, I mentioned this to you, Craig Tiley, one of our former students, years and years ago. The Australian Open Tournament Director, Craig Tiley, says he is worried about the future of doubles in professional tennis as the sport undergoes a process of rapid innovation in order to chase new and emerging audiences. What do you think about doubles? You watch the Australian Open. Doubles, doubles, doubles. I love doubles.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch much. I mean, there's a few teams that I really like to watch, and I didn't get to. I mean, I wasn't really tuning in on the ESPN app, so I mean, I'm sure they were showing it on one of the channels. But I mean, Bopana, a little younger than I am. What is he, like 44 and he's number one in the world?
43.
So. It's incredible. So, and then there was, you know, I watched a little bit of the women. I know there were, the final was amongst the, or maybe it was the semi that was amongst the former teammates that were so dominant, Krejcikova and Siniaková. But yeah, I mean, it's really hard to find. I mean, I can't find, it's amazing how it's so hard to find doubles on ESPN, and yet, I have no issues finding pickleball on ESPN when it's Blake, Agassi, and McEnroe.
I think it's unfortunate where, you know, people really want to see the marquee players. They want to see the personalities. And I don't understand the entertainment on one of the major stadiums. They're having a concert during one of the doubles matches. And I mean, it's tennis, it's tennis. The Happy Slam, I understand, is a big party and they're obviously generating revenue. Any of the major tournaments, it just seems like so many people are in the food court. And, you know, and again, Joe Public, so many people in the mainstream, they're just playing doubles. But you know, with the money, I mean, way, way back when, you know, people talk about equal prize money for men and women, but then you think about equal prize money for, you know, singles and doubles, not necessarily equal prize money, but fair prize money. And you know, Jimmy Connors won Wimbledon and the US Open with Nastasi, you know, shortly after that, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, the $1 million baby. And the best players in the world can afford not to play doubles. I think the people learning how to play, they need to play doubles as our skill acquisition. But you know, at one time the leaders, administrators of tennis were talking about dropping doubles. And then that's where the scoring format was no ad and the 10 point match tiebreaker. But any other comments, guys, on doubles? How could it improve?
Well, I mean, let's go back to Yvonne's home tournament. I mean, Indian Wells does an unbelievable job about promoting doubles. I mean, every year, obviously, there's like a large gap sometimes between potentially the last event that they played. Some of them you maybe haven't played since Australia. Maybe some are coming from the clay in South America. So they actually, usually the Indian Wells draw, doubles draw is packed. So usually you see... And I think they added a bonus that if, if you win singles and doubles, you make an extra million. So, I mean, it's, I mean, for years you would see, you know, Federer, Wawrinka played a double together. You had Nadal and Lopez play together. You had Djokovic playing, you know, you had a lot of big names. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me where, you know, some of the biggest moments in the last couple of years involved was, around in doubles, right? Let's say when Federer retired, you know, everybody's watching his matches. You know, obviously he was retiring, but I mean, even Laver Cup does a much better job of promoting doubles than, you know, regular tournaments. So obviously it is name driven. You need to get the name guys involved. But I mean, there has to be a way to do it. I mean, it just seems like it's
no, for sure.
Poorly thought out.
I think an opinion is, at least from my perspective, as a 24-year-old, you know, on the socials, let's say tennis TV, different ATP tournaments, and the slams have different organizations that do their social media. But for example, the social media aspect of it, they have a lot more promotion and more videos and more content and more clips and activities that they do with the singles players that kind of show their personality and they kind of bring them out more towards the public. So the public can get to know them better as opposed to the doubles players. They don't do that for the doubles players. So as an audience, someone from the audience, oh yeah, I remember watching, you know, this clip, highlights of this. Like they do so much back end and content afterwards off the matches. And you get to know the players, at least the singles players, very well. And so when you have a choice to watch doubles or singles, you're going to go to watch someone that you've seen before, which, so, you know, it's nothing wrong with that, but I think a good step in the right direction in the area of, let's say, social media is just to do the same with doubles. So you get to understand the, you know, the personalities more and have the fans connect with the players, just understand who they are, first of all. And when you brought up Indian Wells and have the prize money for singles and doubles, and then the singles players ended up transferring over, transferring quote unquote playing doubles that usually don't play. For example, I was there one year when Tsitsipas played with Feliciano Lopez. Everyone was at that match. I mean, it was great. And not to say that, well, there has to be a monetary value now for singles players to start playing doubles. From the player's point of view, okay, sure, now they have an extra incentive, but now fans are actually excited about doubles. Like, wow, man, doubles can actually be very fun, not just because of the players. And I feel like organizations could do a better job just thinking of better ideas, as in the monetary bonus, or better job on social media, more clips and stuff, just to promote the actual doubles players. Because I guarantee you right now, even myself, I couldn't name you the top 10 doubles players in the world. I can name you like 3 or 4 or 5 of them maybe, but I can name you the top, you know, 60 singles players. And I feel like that's a lot due to a snowball effect where, you know, players that are well known, they want to make more content off of them. And then it just snowballs into all it is just the singles players. So I don't know. That's my opinion. I think it can be reversed. I think we can just start investing more into the doubles players And I'd like to see it more often. I enjoy watching doubles as well.
I think one thing, the word consistency at Indian Wells, it's say what, a 10-day event. So it's not your normal winter 1 week. And the singles players can bump the doubles players. So if someone is ranked 42 in doubles and somebody who's ranked 41 in singles, the singles player takes priority. With, I think it should just be straight across the board. Say, for example, Austin Krajicek is somebody who's 33 years old now, and you know, obviously being ranked high is one in the world for 24 weeks. He's obviously doing really well now, but at 33, you would think, okay, you know, he could have been hired as a coach for somebody that he could coach in singles or help out, mentor, and then they pair up in doubles. Years ago, Raven Claussen, who's been a guest on our podcast, and he spent nearly 5 years with us, and you know, he knows the information that we've acquired very, very well. And he played team tennis, was out in San Diego with Taylor Fritz. And Taylor's parents talked to Raven about coaching. At that time, Raven was still playing. And you know, I heard that and I said, you know, you should have taken that project on. And you know, it doesn't mean you have to coach 52 weeks out of the year. But actually, through Brad Dancer, I contacted him, the Illinois coach, because I heard that Kevin Anderson was looking for a coach. The job was actually offered. You know, I said, okay, let me let Raven Claussen know. And Brad Dancer let Kevin Anderson's family know. And Raven was offered the job at that time. He was still playing. I think he would have been perfect guy to work with Kevin Anderson, who could have certainly, you know, like anybody, worked on perhaps his volley or a certain part of his game. And some things could happen if it was changed. I go way back to junior tennis, the late Bobby Curtis. He loved doubles. And at one point in Florida, 1 weekend a month was designated to just doubles only, and nobody played. And I don't think it was gutsy enough. I believe it was a Florida Tennis Association. I don't think it was from the national headquarters. But your ranking would be bumped up 15% of your ranking. Your overall ranking was based on your doubles ranking. But yeah, doubles needs to be saved. It needs to be, to say at our level, it needs to be saved in regard to skills. I mean, kids, oh my word, serving and staying back. I mean, it's just, these people don't even know where to stand when they play doubles. But something needs
to be
done.
I'll take it a step further when it comes to doubles. I'm waiting for the day that we get a 17 or 18 day Grand Slam, because the day is coming, right? Because we're already at 15 days. So adding another day, that way that there's an extra weekend, you know, it doesn't seem like we're that far away from 16 or 17 day slams. And if that's the case, the players are already at the tournament a week before anyway. Why wouldn't they start doubles? I mean, start the tournament, start doubles early, and basically, I'm sure the players will probably play. You know, more money goes into the pot. I'm sure everybody wins. I mean, it's that's the one I'm waiting for. We're already at 15, so 16 and 17 can't be that far away.
Yeah. Let's go to the Australian doubles. Australian Open. We are going to pick up with our donors, and next year a group of us are going to go to the Aussie Open and report from the grounds. Wouldn't that be nice to I think overall the group of us went down and say, this is our comments from this match, instead of again, I enjoy listening to the commentators on TV, but some things are missing, the nuts and bolts. We can talk a little bit about that, but why don't we start with the women's final, guys? What do you got for the women's final?
Women's final.
You guys can start. I didn't wake up at 3:30 in the morning like you guys did for those matches.
No, it's okay. We understand. We're troopers, though. We're a little bit mentally stronger than you. We woke up and got it in. No, I think I dozed off for a couple games, too. So, but I got a couple notes here. For example, one of the best things I'd like to start off with is Lee Na, she showed up and they had a little segment either before the match started or during where they showed Lee Na surprising, surprising Zhang. I don't know if that's the way to pronounce your last name.
I'm really not, expert on pronouncing Chinese names, but that's a good shot.
And they seemed like good buddies, or they were supportive of each other. And they showed how Zhang actually started playing or got inspired. Again, you look this up, but to make sure. But she got inspired because of Lee Na and her Australian Open win. And she showed up to support Zhang in the final. And what was amazing to me and why I had to write this down was, out of respect, she never showed up to the actual arena. She never sat in the stadium. She didn't want to take away from Zhang's spotlight and have the attention even slightly be on her. And I was just like, wow, that's just that was worth waking up at whatever
hour. Classy. I think one thing with Sabalenka, I love to listen to the athletes. And she said after the U.S. Open, and we commentated on the U.S. Open match, just certainly some things going on with, I mean, it was early hours, there's a morning, but airport runs and having juniors here working on their game or coaches, the visitors we had. But she just said, you know, she had looked at the film and she just really needed to work on her pro shots and volleys. I think she's an ESFP, which would be on the Myers-Briggs. The descriptor, she'd be an entertainer. She's a roller coaster. She laughs when she's off the court, but sometimes she's not laughing when she's on the court. Her highs can be high and her lows can be low. And it just seems like she is walking a tightrope where she can fall off of it. But she's so positive and so aggressive. And you have to have a great game to defend against someone playing that big.
No, another great storyline. I mentioned the Lee Na one with Zhang, with Sabalenka. They had another storyline with her where they mentioned her father and how her father passed away, and his dream or wish or goal or for his daughter was that she would win prediction. I guess you can say that she would win 22 majors by the time she turned 25, and she would achieve the number one ranking. And this was the last major she was in. No, this is the last major before she turns 26, and she won it. And that was her second major, and she had achieved previously last year the number one ranking. So it was kind of like this like, you know, fairy tale story. So just cool moments like that. Like,
oh, there's so many great stories like that. Triumph with. Her father died at a young age, but a hockey player. Okay. Knock on wood, a little plug for hockey players. It's a great sport. So there had to be a little character transferred from her father's hockey background to her tennis background. What about her opponent?
Zhang, I'm not much, just from what I heard from the commentators, They admitted that she was a low percentage server. Just quotes that I wrote down from the commentators. Low percentage server, doesn't have a high serve percentage. She actually didn't face a seeded player until the final. So no seeded players. Surprisingly, even with her low serve percentage, she had the most aces on the women's side in the tournament. So it's very surprising. Her serve motion, it's quite an interesting motion. She's hit millions of balls, I'm sure, to get to that way of hitting it. She fans the serve. Her toss motion is very erratic, I would say. Maybe not the best word, but she turns her body and then she kind of flings the ball up and she gets it there. She does fan the serve. I'd say she's palm up on her serve. So it's surprising that she got the most aces stat, but even with a low percentage for serve.
With athletic ability, fun to watch, great athlete. Go back to Yvonne Goolagong. What a mover. Yeah, but the serve, I mean, I actually had the calculator out and she was in the 60s on a lot of second serves. And actually Dave Anderson's student from years and years, I'd say, you know, age 8 to 16, or, you know, maybe even a little before that. Ashton Kruger has been taught, you know, here's a squared out ready position, make a unit turn, rackets set up like a volley pattern on both sides. We call it a tabletop, like a volley, and had a follow through. Kruger went three sets. I didn't see that match. But yeah, our serve, again, she's a great, great player. And I think when people listen to us, you know, we're not necessarily saying she has to change her serve, but if, biggest word in the dictionary, if you could go backwards and take someone, you know, that athletic, you know, she spent so many years now in Spain. She's based in Spain. It's like Irani, the Italian player who spent a lot of time with this academy and that academy. I remember she was in the French Open final against Serena. And, you know, what a great fighter, but it's like, wow. I mean, it's a serve could definitely could be improved upon. Then you turn to her forehand and the grip she has on the forehand side. That's where, right now what's going on is the PTR, the Professional Tennis Registry. And one of our students, sent me a text and said that he's talking to somebody about the great base or the curriculum we put together, and said, well, as far as stylistic coaching, you want to run the other way. And, you know, I like the Ron White line, the comedian, you can't fix stupid. And with, again, we're not, you know, here saying, okay, gee, I mean, people don't really talk about Iga Swiatek's grip on the forehand side, which is pretty much the same as Coco Gauff's. But if some of these players were taught better, I mean, Sabalenka's got a great serve. And, you know, she obviously, it's very open. It's been a lot written about how she's made some changes on it. But it's tennis math, our podcast on tennis math. I mean, the height of her Sabalenka's toss. So I think what happens when commentators, spectators, people are watching tennis, parents, juniors, it's like anything goes. Well, I think you have to look for every competitive edge. Is your child going to be as athletic as Shang? Is your child going to be as big and strong, as powerful as Sabalenka? So I think you just have to look for every possible edge.
Yeah, her toss, Sabalenka's toss, it is quite high. She last year had the quote unquote yips. She on average double faulted 14 times a match last year. And for the whole tournament, she only double faulted 10 times this year on the Australian Open. So big difference, 10 times for the whole tournament versus 14 times a match last year. They did mention, again, commentators mentioned how she went to see a mechanical individual to help her with a serve, but that mechanical individual remained unnamed. So pretty interesting. Some more quotes from just the commentators that I jotted down. She's winning by being a more complete of a player. So if you watch her play, that's 100% true in my opinion. And she was looking to come forward. Ball was up in the air. She didn't wait for it to bounce. She tacked the net. She went forward. She was really showing what she had worked on. And in the interviews leading up to the final, she said, yes, this is what I've been working on. Short balls coming in. And she showed it. I think she's doing better, playing better. And I don't see her going away for a while.
Actually, we posted an article with the Canadian, sports science, not necessarily a biomechanist, but in the sports science field, works with athletes from many sports, and can't recall his name offhand, but you know, so that was mentioned. But coming back to Shang serve, I just the comments and the comments from the commentators. There's not a lot of nuts and bolts as far as common sense or even just basic biomechanical principles on how someone like Shane could serve better.
One thing, along those lines, sorry to cut you off there, Andres, but a few more points from the commentators that you just mentioned, Steve. The one couple good things that I did hear were Zhang's pulling off on her forehand return. I believe Mary Jo Fernandez said that. I could be wrong on that. I didn't write down which commentator said that, but in my head, that's who I remember saying it.
I heard Patrick McInerney say something almost verbatim about Djokovic's forehand when he didn't do so well against center in those first two sets, especially. But go ahead.
Yeah, and another thing I heard was she has a hitch in her serve. So mechanical, but then right after that, she followed with, but it's good after a toss. So her swing's good up until the hitch, not good at the hitch, and then afterwards, it's all good. So that, I found that a little funny. And she also, another from the commentators, it was, she needs to learn to get her toss behind her on her second serve for the kick.
Alex Mickelson, we had a few people contact us. We had a podcast. It was, primarily talking about his backstory and where he is and how exciting it is. He's doing so well, so fast, and 19 years old. And someone said, well, he has a hitch on his serve. And my comment back to one person was, so is Federer. Technique is not everything. I think that's where, say, for example, but players that are entering the game, before, just what number are you going to say? Age 10, age 11, age 10, age 9. I'd like to say 9. If you start kids 5 years old and they're playing multiple sports, just go back to the Welby Van Horn balance, understanding the tennis math with grips with Braden, and here are the checkpoints based on the dimensions court, physical laws. Kids should really have a solid foundation by the age of 9, even if they're not playing full-time tennis.
One thing to add, Steve, with that is, I feel like the more I watch tennis and the more I see a player have, technical inefficiencies, or say, okay, they can do this better, the more respect I have for them, because to get to that level of the game, and you need to be such a fighter, and you need to be so gritty and such a complete competitor on court to get to that level with those inefficiencies. And I had written down as an example Zhang's serve, where she, like I mentioned, she fans it in her toss and palm up, but she's there, she's in the final, and it's amazing. All credit to her that she's able to make it to that level. Amazing.
Well, then coming back to the word consistency, will she be back to a final like that, even though she has a great competitive spirit and great movement? But going back to technique, ignorance is bliss. Vic Braden, once you start to think about technique, you're going to finish second in a field of two. If someone's going to make changes in their game, they have to be all in. That's where we make these narrated slow motion analysis tapes. And, you meet someone when they're 15 years old, and again, repeating myself, the light at the end of the tunnel is a train coming right at them. They say that, a young kid goes, I want to play college tennis. And, we always tease, well, if they come up with a D5, there's Division I, Division II, Division III, but you got to be all in once you're going to be making a change. I do think that's a challenge for college coaches, for sure. But, working with someone who has a flawed serve, a Peter Burwash line from years ago, the art is where you start. You got to be able to pick out the primary flaw. But also, too, is you have to have the trust of that player. And that's a big, big problem in tennis, is that, the Darren Cahills and the Brad Gilberts, they're great, but they're confidants and they're mentors. They're not really getting in there and doing the nitty gritty. As far as you can go way back to Darren Cahill with Leighton Hewitt. What a great fighter, what a great competitor, a champion. I do think a lot of people think, well, you get to the age of 15, you don't want to be making technical changes in your game. but it depends on who that 15-year-old is and where that 15-year-old is. And, you know, we meet, you know, children who want to play college tennis. And I mean, Division III is, especially on the top teams, it's a respectable level. But yeah, the word change, I think in any walk of life, people need to embrace it and say, okay, I'm going to do it and just totally get after it. You can't tiptoe around it. It's like, you got to meet it really head on. Anything else on the women's match? You have some stats or?
I have stats.
Well, I got a few things here. Hold on a second. Let me get a word in here between you two. So going back to Zhang and the fixing the Yip Center second serve, the same could be said for Zverev. I mean, he went out there and, I mean, I don't know. I can't remember how many double faults he must have had in the U.S. Open final against Dominic Thiem, but he really was easily in the double digits. So that seems to have been rectified. You were talking about, you know, one of the parts about Zhang that I found interesting that I didn't hear them really mention, and maybe, again, I wasn't up at 3:30 like you guys, but Per Riba, the coach for Zhang, you know, finally, I mean, he was on the team with Gilbert and Coco Gauff at the Open, and now here in Australia, the next one, you know, it's a pretty impressive effort for a guy that I hadn't really heard of as a coach on the women's tour, and basically two phenomenal slams in a row. And, you know, I'm not sure if they really picked up on that. I mean, you guys would be better to tell me.
No, and, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seemed like they didn't want to take the shine off their fellow colleagues. But and then the last part, when you were talking about the commentators and their analysis of the serve, I mean, it's been a point of mine for a long time now that it's just the commentators just, they prepare worse than McEnroe does for pickleball. because basically there is, as Steve says, there's very little any constructive comments. And the part that's really bad, and I usually get annoyed listening to Chris Fowler, but in his defense, he seems like he's the only one that might even remotely prepare. And, you know, I do think it's a little bit dangerous when you have someone that really is not a tennis player that goes out and, you know, spouts off his opinions on tennis, the mental, the physical, the this and that. You know, and kids are impressionable. Hopefully not that many kids are up at 3:30 in the morning watching it, but, you know, it's a long, I mean, that wasn't the one I listened to. I got to listen to the Wally Masur, Mark Pecci, and John Fitzgerald commentary. So it was a little better, I would say, than the typical Fowler ESPN crew.
Going back to one comment you made with Zverev, all these sound bites, he made one comment about his older brother. I believe his brother's 10 years older. And he said, well, no one listens to his siblings. It's always baffled me that, you know, he doesn't come in more. He doesn't volley more. You know, I heard Raven Glasson say one time that when he was 14 years old, he pretty much knew he was going to be one of the best players in the world. Great how he came back for some such a severe ankle sprain, but he moves, he, you know, again, just, that's something just straight across the board is that, you know, people are playing, it's brain memory. It's how they're programmed, all the way to the Australian Open. It's big time celebration of tennis, but it's like, there's a moat around the net, you know, it's, you know, there's alligators. So if you get, 6-7 feet from the net, your life's in jeopardy. It's just amazing. But I think as far as, digging deep, whether we went back and we talked a couple weeks ago, we went over Alex Mickelson. It was a great help to, Mark Walpole, who was part of our training program, say, okay, tell us what it was like, what the kid was like, or, you know, Yvonne, who knows him from junior tennis, where his sister played, you know, doubles in local tournaments with him. And, yeah, so I think, especially when someone appears out of nowhere, you know, it's like, say, Alex Mickelson, you know, maybe he's not out of nowhere, but Zverev has been around for a while. But I do think from the commentating, you know, you just think of people are trying to learn to play the game. What do they really learn from commentating? And you know, again, the gentleman who was critical of our program at this PTR symposium, and we get that all the time. And I think I'd like to watch that gentleman's students play tennis. Okay, let me come to your place and the Vic Braden line. Let me see how's the most uncoordinated kid in your corner of the world hit a tennis ball. But yeah, it's an opportunity for more learning to take place. I think one thing that was nice is that when they had the aerial view looking down at the court, you know, where the ball was going.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was relatively new. I wonder if that is because it was filmed out of Australia. Australia is known to be a leader with innovative ideas for improving the game of tennis.
I'm still bothered that the tiebreak was referred to as a 7-point tiebreaker instead of a 12-point tiebreaker. But it was funny hearing all my non-tennis playing friends. That's how they refer to it. They didn't really know the. I actually never knew the history of the 9-point breaker until Steve mentioned to me about the sudden death. And then when he mentioned it, I did remember listening to Bud Collins as a kid talk about the tiebreaker being sudden death, and then the 12-point tiebreaker being referred to as lingering death.
Right. Well, the 9-point tiebreaker was 2-2-2-3, so the score would be 4-all, and then one player had an extra serve. You know, I've heard many things where the tiebreaker after that first point, instead of having to go to the ad court, that the righty gets to go to the deuce court and the lefty. That would be pretty confusing for young kids to play that. But the tiebreaker with James Van Allen in 1970 came out. It really put tennis on TV because before the tiebreaker, you couldn't put tennis in a time capsule. You have some stats on the women's match?
I got stats. Yeah, there was a few more things I'd like to share. Score was 3-2, total amount of points. 46-62, 5 aces to 3 aces, just some things as I'm scrolling through on the Aussie Open website, which is unbelievable with the stats, by the way. It tells you pretty much everything you want to know. I'm sure I can find a couple of things that's like, well, did they chart that? Maybe not. But if you guys have questions on stats, I can bring it up. For example, on break points, zero breaks, 4 chances to break, 0 for Zhang, 6 chances to break for Sabalenka. She broke 3 times. 19 winners. Actually, Zhang had more winners than Sabalenka. Interesting. 16 unforced to 14 unforced. Three return winners. You know, fastest serves, 189 kilometers to 183, the latter being for Zhang. I'd like to mention how in an interview or before the match, they have that pre-match interview, and Sabalenka said that she considers Zhang's forehand to be her best weapon. And what's interesting is at the end of the first set, and I don't know why, but personally for me, when I watched that final, it felt like Sabalenka was hitting a bigger ball off the forehand and the backhand side. Maybe it was how she was grunting. Maybe it was just her presence and her size. But if you would have asked me, like, who's hitting a bigger ball, like, without question, off the forehand and the backhand wing, Sabalenka did. But the stats came through, and after the first set, they were even on the forehand side, and Zhang was actually faster on the backhand side. So just interesting stats. Another thing is Zhang actually had unbelievably good body language when she was down a set and a break. And that's just something I had to note down. Like, she was pumping herself up. It was a set and a break down. She was getting destroyed, and she was still in it. She was still fighting for it. Yeah. Sabalenka, she stays in the pocket very well. She hits backhands when it's a backhand. She hits forehands when it's a forehand. We mentioned that with Alex Mickelson as well. He does that as well, very well. I wrote down that Sabalenka is like a bulldozer from the baseline. She just, you know, we mentioned playing your opponent like a bowling pin, and she plays it like a bowling. She's just going to knock you over. You want to explain what that bowling pin analogy is, Steve?
Yeah, for sure. It will work like a charm. The other day we had a player who was an 8-2, pretty easy to remember, an 8-2 playing a 10-2 on the UTR. Two boys, say a 14-year-old, I'm guessing 18-year-old, and the 8.2 player did not know the other player was a 10.2. And player 8.2 player is very respectful, and I said, hey, this is the bowling pin. Just aim right to the middle. The player comes to the net, aim right at the player. And, this is obviously not the highest level play, a boy 8.2 and a boy 8.2 and 10.2. But through the middle, the pocket, the bowling pin is right in the middle. Now you're going to bowl a strike. You got to hit the first pin. And in the pocket comes from football. The quarterback's not going to scramble. And it's just amazing how many players don't stay in the pocket and avoid hitting a backhand. And, it's amazing. People like years ago, we always say with Sampras came to the net, no one copied him. Or you watch, Djokovic, his ready position, and now he has a great backhand because he hits backhands. Our juniors will get confused because they think we're telling him never to run around the forehand. We're saying, no, get a backhand first. And then if you're going to do that, you're going to be inside the court. But, when you come back to the point separation, why don't you put that to a percentage, Yvonne, 46 points to 62. And, you're pretty close to 100 points in every, 50 points per set. And we're always saying, okay, generally set has about 50 points, two sets, 100 points. And so I think a lot of juniors would think, well, the score was 6-3, 6-2. But what were the percentages?
44% for Zhang. And then we got 56% for Sabalenka.
44-56. This is a stat we share often. For 10 years in a row, exactly 10 years in a row, Nadal and Federer appear in New York for the U.S. Open. So they've played 8 months. And the stat was for their 8 months going into the U.S. Open. 10 years in a row, both of them were 55%, like 55.1, 55.2. So to go back to the drawing board, we'll take 100 points and say, okay, or better yet on a board, in this case, 46 to 62. So you go 47 to 61, 48 to 60, 49 to 59. But there's well, let's go to the drawing board. Where can we win those points? Where can we make the turnaround? I tell juniors, if you can play a match that's that close where you're getting 55% of the points and you can go out and play that match and just not miss wide, I'm betting on you to win. I'm betting you on you to win. That's in a junior tennis match. Now, Sabalenka, we don't want to take anything away from her. Her level of play would have gone up, obviously, if Shang's level of play went up. But that's something that's buried. On the other hand, too, if a kid loses badly, the breadstick 6-1, bagel 6-0, and they could have won 40% of the points. If you round that off, 60-40, you can round it down to 3-2. Out of 5 points, one player's winning three, the other player's winning two. But you got to know where you're winning points and where you're losing points. I do think it's amazing, to hear Sabalenka say she went back and looked at video with her loss against Coco Gauff in the U.S. Open. I mean, I know for a fact there's not much video used at every level of tennis, college tennis, pro tennis. With stats, Roger Federer was asked, before 2017, he didn't use stats, didn't analytics. So he was asked, and he said the only time he looked at stats was when they're put in front of him, at Wimbledon every year when they're waiting for the press group to organize, they put the stats in front of the player. So the follow-up question is, what about your coach? And basically, he said, my coach doesn't either. We just go on hunches. I can assure you in other sports, they're not going on hunches.
I think it's interesting when you talk about the 62-46. I mean, I always pose that question to kids And I say, well, how many points difference was your match? And they'll always say, well, I mean, obviously the differential is 16. But I'll ask, how many points is that? And they'll always say 16. And I'm like, no, it's really 8. It's, you know, how can you figure, I mean, can you figure out 8 situations in that 100 points that you could have played differently? Or, you know, not to say that you're going to win them all, but I mean, yeah, it's, I think it really, when a kid gets that, it can really be eye opening.
With back to my hockey background, as a little kid, you know, yeah, I got 3 goals, but then the coach will, you know, yeah, but you were on the ice when they scored 4 times, so you're a -1. So that's a huge stat. Maybe the number one stat in hockey is what's your plus minus. And the formula we have comes from Bill Jacobson. It's plus is a winner, minus F is a forced error, minus, unforced error. So the point only ends 3 ways. So in your plus column is winners and forced errors. So plus minus F, minus equals your plus minus. The if you were to go out and hit 1 winner and make 1 error, hopefully it's an intelligent error, but you make an unforced error. In other words, it's long, it's not wide. And then you can apply pressure and you force the player to miss. You know, an effective serve, you play an approach shot, they miss a passing shot. It's tic-tac-toe. It's 2-1, you win 6-0, 6-0. If you could do that consecutively. I tell kids all the time, I said, you play tic-tac-toe? I said, okay, let's play where I get to go twice and you get to go once. I'm pretty confident. You know, Yvonne's a smarter guy than him. But I play tic-tac-toe with Yvonne. I get to go twice, he gets to go once. I mean, I put 2 X's on the board, he puts 1-0. So then I get to put 2 X's on the board, I win. And that's pretty much how junior tennis goes. I mean, the unforced errors are off the charts. And where the unforced errors are, you can just take a piece of paper, draw a tennis court, and now you're told not to use red when you are marking on a kid's paper. You know, it's a nosebleed. And you just take it doesn't have to be a red pen, but it would think it would add to the effect. And you just make a dot where they miss the ball. And there's a cluster of errors, like there's a cluster of peanuts in a candy bar. And it's, you know, if you've seen the first 20 points of a junior tennis match, you've seen the junior tennis match. You know, the parents are there with their fingers crossed and hopefully they're not climbing the fence. But typically the match doesn't change. And what's really scary is they'll play that way for years. You see them years later, technically it's almost money. That's how they've been playing tennis for 5-6 years. And these are the swing patterns. Those are the swing patterns. That's how powerful, sophisticated the brain is. Anything else on the women's match?
Yeah, I got last few comments here. Another snippet from the commentators, whereas she likes to go cross court. She likes to give herself room to hit with power. There's 4.5 feet more if you hit cross court. And so that's another great line, I feel like. So hit cross court gives you more time, more distance to hit bigger shots. One more thing is she was down 1-3 in the second, Zhang, and she hit her first drop shot. And the first thing that the commentator said is she should use that more often. She didn't play a single volley. Zhang did 0 volleys, 2 drop shots, and 6 doubles. So it definitely was a baseline game. Even though Sabalenka did force more than she had in the past, from my opinion.
No, I think if you watch a 100 points, there's not one overhead hit. I know I'm unhappy camper. You know, what we've put together, the system of systems, a great base curriculum, you have to be able to play from the service line in. You got to be able to bend and jump. You got to be able to play volleys and overheads. To be a complete player, you got to be able to serve and volley and doubles. You got to be able to play singles and doubles. And yeah, our game at the very top, I mean, I do respect the players for their competitiveness, their spirit. But yeah, players could be taught to be much more efficient, but you got to go back. You don't have to go back to the cradle, but they are going to go to their grave with the way they play. I think Joel Drucker said it so well on our podcast. If you're, you know, trying to teach a kid to go to the net at age 15, it's like they're learning a third language. Basics have to turn into instincts. And, but again, with Sabalenka, hats off to her for being so aggressive, playing so big. When the point's over, Jim Lehrer, ask yourself, did you play percentage tennis? Or did you play aggressive tennis? And I got some other thoughts here on other, just a few other points from the, I guess we could talk about a few of these things before we get into the men's match.
Did you guys watch the Coco Gauff Sabalenka match?
I did.
In the semis?
Yeah, I watched a ton of tennis. I pulled
that's the one that,
three all nighters.
I found it interesting. The main topic of discussion was always about how Roddick worked with Coco Gauff for 2 days, and it made it seem like, you know, changed her serve overnight. I mean, I found it hard to believe, and sure enough, you know, under pressure in the semifinals, she broke down a little bit. But I always find it a little bit interesting how quickly people think change can occur.
Well, with Andy, I liked it when people used to ask him how he served, how he learned to serve, and he said, I don't know. And but now I've heard him recently say it's from the legs. Stanford Boston, South African. I know. I was traveling with my son. He was one of the USTA coaches at that time. I mean, he was coaching a young Victor Lillo who spent years with us. He told me his go-to guy was Mark Spann, who's one of our students. So Mark's a South African, Stan's a South African. Stan was very humble saying that because he was coaching Andy. Andy, it's on that Breakpoint show with Marty Fish. He's got a palm-up serve when he's a little kid. And I believe his mother's first name, Blanche. And anyway, the word she uses, his serve was pitiful. And then he just got frustrated. He put his racket in the salute position and just out of anger hit it. And he's been quoted saying, you know, did it for 15 years after that. I mean, I do think they're confidants. I do think when it's so important, you know, you're talking to somebody who's been there before. And, you know, even if the player, mind over matter, they haven't really made any changes, but they just believe they're hitting the ball better. They're just more confident. They're just being more aggressive. They're letting it go. So, you know, it's, frustrating in one hand where, you know, the basics are just not understood throughout all of tennis. At tennis teaching conferences, you know, pros will get together, and I mean, the profession, the macho male ego, it's rather sad in this country where it's 85-90% male, and you know, it's like, well, no, we all know basics. I like this drill, you like that drill. People are happy about talking about different drills, and again, coming back to a couple people, this one coach I mentioned earlier. He's at the Professional Tennis Registry Symposium. He goes, basically, most of the lectures, he said, are on how to make money, not how to make players. I'm always very curious to watch the former touring pros when you get a chance to see their children hit tennis balls. That's where. Peter Korda and his wife, they've done a pretty good job with Sebastian Korda. I mean, as far as how he hits a tennis ball. It was great to see him win a match playing Davis Cup. What else, guys?
Hewitt's
trying to move on to the next final.
Yeah, just one thing that I just remember was Hewitt's son. We watched Hewitt's son play. First name?
Cruz.
Cruz would play, and it was a sight.
One thing with Cruz, young kid playing the Australian Open, he got the warm center up because there's a connection, obviously, between Hewitt and I got to give Darren Cale credit. He spent a lot of years with, you know, Leighton Hewitt. And, you know, he was offered this job and that job. He said, no, I want to finish it out. And he stayed with Hewitt till he turned number one, became number one in the world. Leighton Hewitt had a reset back in. So it was Demonar.
Demonar, yeah.
Who's easily one of the fastest tennis players in the world. And he's really jumped up the rankings. Great competitor. Now, Cruz Hewitt used to, but when I watched him play, and that's one thing with you know, television now, I watch quite a few juniors. But he certainly has a few extra segments on his forehand. Mm-hmm. But I do think he'd be another example. So it's like, well, that can work in today's tennis. I was quite surprised to watch Lindsay Davenport's son, Jagr. Now, how did I happen to watch this is we have a kid visiting who lost to him in a match. He goes, yeah, I played him. And I said, okay, let's watch him play. And, you know, so his grandfather just recently passed away, Dick Leach, you know, player and former coach at USC, wins national championships. And then, I mean, his father's a tennis player at a high level, but then his uncle, Rick Leach, I think he has five majors. Lindsay Davenport wins Wimbledon doubles, playing with a gal that we coach in a, you know, roundabout way. I mean, with Karina Morariu, her father, Alvin's brain surgeon, but he's studying tennis. I used to see him at teaching conferences. I used to chart two of her matches a week on Bill Jacobson's CompuTennis, and I finally convinced Alvin, let's film her. And, you know, there's a clip on our course tennis intelligence play all the way to Wimbledon. She used to take the racket low, high, low. And, you know, she had a very good game overall, really rock solid, but there was just a couple things that needed to be changed. But I remember she was scheduled to go to Europe. This gal, she only played two national tournaments. She became 28 in the world. So she wins Wimbledon doubles. But here's the point is Lindsay Davenport wins Wimbledon. She's, you know, so she's married into the Leach family. And obviously her son, hats off to him. He's playing in the Australian Open Junior Tournament. So he's a great player. And she says, in my family, I'm not even allowed to talk about doubles. So just like with all the extra moves on Leach's forehand, I shouldn't say Leach's forehand, Cruz Hewitt, not that it's wrong, but Jagr Leach stayed back most of the time. He didn't serve and go forward. So it just makes you think, you know, that the players today are like, well, that's the modern forehand. You know, we're, again, sitting in section F, eating a hot dog. Go, hey, boys, go get some popcorn and shut up. But it just surprises me that, you know, you be around those tennis minds, well, if someone's going to attack, you know, Cruz Hewitt's forehand. Or, you know, Jagr Leach, does he watch the best doubles players in the world right now? Like, say, the who's playing with Rajiv Ram, Joe?
Salisbury.
I mean, how are those guys playing? But yeah, the juniors, I spent quite a bit of time watching the juniors from the Australian Open.
Yeah, with Cruz, I found it surprising. We mentioned he does not reset his backhand. He doesn't go low, high, low, from what I saw. And another interesting point about that match was every seat in that stadium was filled for his match. And I'm like, I was amazed. It was there were the attendance for his match. It was like a second round junior match. It was full. I'm like, you don't get like men's singles first rounds match this big. It's amazing the support that he had. I mean, amazing.
What was the beautiful Russian girl? Help me out, guys.
Which one? There's so many of them.
So many of them, yes. Pam Shriver called her Hornikova. When she played, there's a lot of people in the stands. The Aussies love the Aussies. Coming back to doubles, where does the money go? I mean, it just needs to be like it used to be. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice if, I mean, I've never really enjoyed watching senior tennis. But even, you know, say money, where does the money go? If they had money for doubles and you took the best doubles players in the world and let's say a Roger Federer, I don't know if you'd want to do that, but. For the four grand slams, you said, well, let's make it 3 weeks. Let's make it longer in the first week. Is you have some of the players are, you know, not, you know, they're not at the level where they can't move. I mean, I don't like to watch senior tennis where the, you know, the players, they can't move at all. But, you know, I'm sure Roger Federer could, you know, if you're really a good player, you're playing with a really good player. The court's 36 feet wide. So you divide it in half, it's 18. If your partner's aggressive, you really only have to cover 15 feet when you serve and come forward. But people, they don't do tennis math. But yeah, you know, like even exhibitions, you know, in other words, you know, people are spending money to watch former marquee players play pickleball. Is there a way to try to, okay, let's be creative and all the money being spent. I know you corrected me on a previous podcast where I said 112,000 for doubles, but it was 112,000 split for mixed doubles. And yeah, so the distribution of money for doubles, so yeah, something needs to be done. You know, I don't know if the Australian Open needs to be rock and roll. You know, having concerts and this going on and that going on with, yeah, the doubles. You know, speaking of doubles, well, first off, go ahead.
No, I'm going to say as the number one fan of the Rick Leach fan club, as the president, you won 9 majors, you won 4 mixed. You disregarded mixed.
So 5. I'm sorry, I disregarded mixed. Thanks. The fact checker.
And then, and I mean, going back to this whole discussion about doubles, I mean, I think, you know, this whole involvement with Saudi Arabia, I mean, it's going to be very interesting because, you know, they could literally just make it where you get the top names and you get them all together and you're playing singles and doubles and you're kind of doing a little bit like the Laver Cup. I mean, I think you mentioned recently about the going back to the barnstorming days of Kramer and these guys where they were just go from city to city. And if you have all those names, you're going to pack the house. I mean, you're basically, you know, I know everybody likes to believe that, you know, the purity of the sport and the slams. And, but I mean, basically TV is going to just follow the, you know, 6 to 10 names that everybody knows. And one reason why I think the women's game actually gets a little bit lack of respect, because I would actually say that there is just as many women that are on a first name basis with the average Joe fan that maybe even more marketable than the men's game.
You know, when I was a kid, 6 NHL hockey teams, and it was only Canadians. I mean, there were 2 Americans. With, I think it was Gordy Roberts and Tommy Williams. So growing up in hockey, it was like, yeah, okay, we want to play college hockey. College hockey was really like 98% Canadian. Even the Canadian kids who played American college hockey, it was like they were written off. You know, okay, they're not going to be playing pro. When like the Jimmy Connors and a John McEnroe, when they got into the game as a kid, tennis was not a professional sport. It wasn't a professional sport until 1968. I mean, Laver didn't play majors between 1962. I mean, he wins the Grand Slam in 1962. He didn't play again until 1969. Then he wins the Grand Slam again. But the time in between, it was amateurs and it was money under the table. A player might have been paid 100 rackets. You know, they just got product and then they sold the rackets. They sold string. I think it was Harrods, where when you won Wimbledon, you got a 28-pound gift certificate at Harrods. I mean, things have changed so much. But this thing with the Saudis, back in the barnstorming days, like a Welby Van Horn was one of the better players in the world. He's a top 10 player in the world. But just being top 10 didn't put him where he would have been one of the headliners, like, say, Budge and Kramer, or Gonzalez and Kramer, Riggs and Budge. They really would play tours of 100 cities. And it'd be interesting that, you know, what could possibly happen in tennis. I could see tennis being at the point where there would be a positive. There's a positive in everything. If a kid's got, you know, there's no fantasy of playing pro tennis. It's like, I'm going to do this to play college tennis. I'm going to do well in the classroom. And they're more realistic in their thinking. You know, I think all sorts of kids growing up, I know a lot of kids are thinking, well, I don't know if I'll go to college. I think I'll just go straight to the pros. And then they find out that it's pretty hard for them to play in college. I thought in the women's doubles, Help me out with the pronunciation of the gal, 38 years old, from Taiwan. She wins mixed and she wins doubles. What a tennis mind. Shay, how do you pronounce
Shay.
Your name?
First name, Shay. Last name, I'm not going to attempt that. I'm not sure.
There's a funny story about Paul McNamee coaching her, and she'd been coaching her a while and several years, and she had never broken the strings. And she asked her coach, what do I need to do? I need to string my rackets. And you know, I broke a string. She was using the same racket. There is a tennis mind. I mean, she's making shots, a lot of calculation with her strokes. But when she serves, they both stay back. They both stay back on her serve. And the other team doesn't attack. You know, they're not staying back on both. In other words, so Shay's at the baseline serving, her partner, player from Belgium, stays back. You can look it up. You know, very good tennis player.
Mertens.
And yeah, that just lets you know where tennis is. I think years ago with a Russian player, Dementieva, I think. She won Olympic gold. She's a good tennis player. You have to check that out, fact check her. But it was really windy at the U.S. Open, and she's serving at really 50 miles an hour, sometimes in the 40s. And Capriati's on the other side. I mean, great ball striker. And, you know, she didn't say, well, I'm just going to play an approach shot and come in. But with that second serve, or that serve overall, the players on the other side, they're not even coming in. You know, and one of the players, Ostapenko, Andy's student, Kim Burrell, an Aussie, number one in Australia. I watched that match, and Burrell had all sorts of chances. And it was home run derby for Ostapenko. I mean, talk about making errors. But I think that's where, I mean, yeah, the players are great, but I do think the commentators really hesitate to be critical. It's like, why are they playing that way? But it's happening in college tennis right now. It's a safe bet. You go to a men's college tennis match, 2 out of 3 teams are playing 1 up, 1 back. You know, because throughout people's careers, they want to win. I want to win now. And there's not much vision for the future. Speaking about doubles, I like to watch people that we have a connection to. And there's a lot more than people would think. Like say Jackson Withrow. I mean, an elevator ride. I mean, Jackson Withrow was sent to me for a week. He signs with Steve Denton at Texas A&M. And people listen to our podcast. Steve's a guest. I mean, I was flattered. We're going to get Pinnum Paul on as a guest. Pinnum Paul's working for Steve. And, you know, Steve saying, well, he comes off the tour. He goes, this is what you do on a volley, you know, and this is what you do. And Pinnum Paul's going, that's wrong. That's wrong. And, you know, Steve called me up and said, hey, I'm finding out I need to learn how to teach. So I know my son Connor won several doubles tournaments with him on the pro tour, the startup, the futures level. But he made the, you know, just curious to see how he plays. I mean, he's playing, you know, he serves and goes forward. He plays doubles. And you have to do as a favor, as fact checker, Andres. So I'm 99% sure he was in the final eight. You know, the eight teams that made it to the end of the year tournament.
I can look at that.
But yeah, that's where, like say, Lance Hamilton, Andy Fitzell, who spent at least 2 years coaching her, he's at the match watching her play. I'm watching her. And, you know, I'm going to talk to the gentleman who spent the most time coaching her next week, I believe, and been doing some homework. And it's like, whoa, I mean, but her tennis, with our school of thought, she doesn't know the red zone from the green zone. And, you know, it's a matter of nerves and this and that. You know, and she's playing on at the same time. What's the girl's name? Andreeva?
Mira Andreeva.
Yeah, so 500 yards away, Andreeva's the same age. She's playing for a spot in the quarterfinals in the main draw. And it's like, no, just take care of what's right in front of you and all this thought about playing pro tennis. Just play tennis. Don't think about pro tennis. Like what Tracy Austin says, pro tennis will find you. You won't find pro tennis. And there's such a long ways between the majors playing as a junior and then playing the Open event. Austin, or excuse me, not Austin, Krychek. It's great that I mentioned Austin Krychek because I'm about to say Roger Federer. So, Austin, you're awesome. With Federer wins Junior Wimbledon, and he wanted to go to the Wimbledon ball, but he's ushered off back to Switzerland, and he has a wild card into a $15,000, $25,000 tournament. He plays Rodrigo Navarro, loses. All these connections. Carla Navarro was a guest on our podcast. I've known her forever. But Roger said he really didn't want to go because he didn't know if he would ever be back at Wimbledon. Because when you play junior Wimbledon, it doesn't mean you're going to play Wimbledon. But one thing, hats off to Alanis. I watched her play her first doubles match. And she did serve and volley every time, first and second serve in doubles. And, you know, she's going off to UNC, and we just had a podcast with Sophia Patel and the connections, and, you know, Sophia Patel, 5 years at UNC, she's earned the trust of those coaches. And, you know, there need to be a meeting of the minds. And, you know, because we ask kids all the time, are you one or two? Ones are all in. And, you know, really it's a language. And you know, coming back to doubles, you know, Patrick Gibson is someone that we watch play. Let's go through some thoughts on Patrick. He's not playing doubles with, and he can play doubles. He's been taught to volley. Now, as a kid, he, like most champions, he was stubborn and he served and stayed back too much. But let's look him up for a second. He played the Finnish player who went five sets. I know a lot of people went five sets with Medvedev. What's the name of the Finnish player who's very good?
Ruusuvuori.
I mean, Patrick just won his third challenger. And he's had a lot of injuries. And that guy, he just loves tennis. You know, just one thing, you know, what was the point spread on that?
I'll give it to you right now.
As you're looking that up. Just one pattern, he got caught too far behind the baseline, hitting slice backhands down the line in the rally. And again, hats off to Patrick Gibson. He's a great player. But Braden used to have a line for that. Hey, stupid. And, you know, to get people to laugh. Hey, stupid. I mean, you're slicing a one-handed backhand down the line to a righty's forehand. But he was very competitive. And I'm going to guess without even knowing that he's at 55%. I mean, he was at 45%.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, I mean, it's like money. I mean, it's going to be right there. That he losing straight set. No, he won the first set. He lost in four, right?
Mm-hmm. Lost in four. He lost 6-4, 3-6, 4-6, 6-7, 4-7 tiebreak.
But the guy serving rockets his own. You know, I mean, is he the fastest cat? I mean, with. The court's 27 feet wide. It's not even a first down. Super Bowl's coming up this week. It's 9 yards wide. And, you know, the old Barry McKay, boy from Cincinnati, I mean, come on. He used to say, he won the Italian Open playing on clay. They said, what did you do? I served and I brought the baseline with me. And, so it's just amazing. It's like serving, no volley. And then in the doubles, I think that if you're at Patrick's level, you play doubles because you want to break out of the challenger circuit. And that's not easy to do. The challenger circuit, much higher level than the futures level. But how many times was he at the net? How many points were played? What was the percentage? Just pushing some buttons here.
114 to 138, so total points. 252. How many times he came to the net? Let me look it up.
By the way, I don't think that people really take the stats. Number one person for me with tennis information is the late Vic Braden. Number two, Bill Jacobson. It's like, you know, if you could talk to somebody who really knows a lot about tennis, I'm going with Bill Jacobson. I mean, I don't want to tell anybody what I think. I want to tell them what I know. I do think we talk about commentating. I enjoy listening to Wally Masur. We talk about you know, storytelling, which I thought that was pretty good, that what he was doing with a couple of his cohorts. What do you got?
I got Patrick Ibsen came in 19 times, won 11, so 58%. I got his opponent, Rusevori, came in 20 times, won 14 of them, so 70%.
But now, but tell me, what percentage of the points did Patrick come in? So he won. Yeah,
let me get that.
Get your calculator rolling. With
heavy duty math here for Ivan.
Yeah, I'm sweating.
The
16 for Patrick. 16% of the points he came in. And for Emil, of his own points. And then of total points, if you would like that as well. So of Patrick's own points that he won, so 114, he came in 16 times. But total, out of all the points, Patrick came in 7.5%. So out of all the points. And for Emil, he came in 7.9%.
With coming back to Lance Hamilton, one comment. Take a long time. We have it, though. I would have to say some of it's on VHS, some of it's on DVD, but we have it. Players that we've worked with and that have been cherry-picked by the USTA, and certainly I think of other federations, a lot of players we've worked with have been cherry-picked by Tennis Canada. And you've got to document development and start the course, stay the course. And with George Goldoff, 29 years old, he just won a challenger playing doubles. And, you know, he was coaching college tennis and 7 years in Tibet. He spent 7 years with us at this place we had in Orlando. I was at Happy Lane was the name of the street. And, you know, so... you know, just a brain trust. I was at a tournament. He was at the same tournament that Patrick was at. And you just think there could be some open communication with, I understand Patrick has somebody very experienced coaching him now and that just like, okay, let's go through the numbers or let's go through the stats. And with, I think if people could, they go into a match and go, okay, you know, 9 out of 10 times I lose this match. And you know that you know Patrick wouldn't be the great player that he is if he thought that way. But at the same time, if you just knew you lost, you're going to lose the match. Would you play it differently? If you knew the numbers, somehow you know there's a magic wand and you know the numbers, but the match is not even played. But you know the numbers, not just that you lost, even if you won, but you know the stats. And there's a lot more to tennis than the stats. And but with that, would you play differently? And, I think of my own son, Connor. I mean, he went to college. And I think in a lot of ways, even though at Ohio State, they really helped him with competitiveness and fitness. But in a lot of ways, his 4 years in college, he lost his game. He didn't play. I think of Ryler DeHart, somebody who was with us forever. I mean, he started with Tomas Olofsted. It was in his tennis tech program. I was working with him via, the term remote wasn't used at that time, but he had won the Florida 12s and I've never met him in person. I've done a lot of video work for him, but at the time he was 13, I'd coached him from that point forward, because I had relocated to Tampa. Then he goes to Illinois and he plays for Craig Tiley, who was a classmate of Tomas Olofsted. So he's going to play Nadal. I happen to be at the US Open because Austin Krejcik, he won Kalamazoo, and I was flattered that I'm invited to go. I went with his father, Rob. And, DeHart gets through qualies and he's playing, ends up, because wins his first round. He's playing Nadal on Arthur Ashe. Well, what an achievement that is. So Steve Denton's there. I go, hey, Denton, come here for a minute. I said, tell DeHart what you think you should do tomorrow against Nadal. And he goes, he just told me, he goes, you should play the way you used to. and serving and going forward more, you know, taking second serves and coming in, knowing what a green light point is, knowing what a body serve is. When people are playing on hard court, so, you know, men's tennis, it's not a shot to women's tennis. The women are serving bigger and bigger. But if you're serving and you're on a hard court and the other person is consistently at the net, I mean, that's not right. I mean, you just got to, you just kill or be killed. You know, I'm going to force before you force. Coming back to doubles a little bit, highlight to the other tournament for me was Rohan Bopanna. His name came up earlier. You know, and certainly watching him play, he's not playing textbook doubles, but you know, that guy, you know, it's amazing. You know, I just think the competitive spirit, the smile on his face. I was flattered one time, Arvind Arvindan talked to Rohan about his academy and that they should go through our training. But I, one time through Arvind, was with Ram Ramanathan 2 different years at the US Open, and he's in the qualies, and I think it was 87 backhands that he hit underspin. He has a two-handed backhand. And the Indian players watched the Indian players, and so we're meeting afterwards, and I said, excuse me, I'll be right back. And I went to the players' lounge, and I found Rohan Bopanna, who really doesn't know me from the man in the moon. I said, Rohan, hey, I mean, we had sat together for like a 3-hour match, and I said, hey, got to do a favor. And he came out to the table. It's a famous, that famous area outside where you walk in at the grounds of the US Open. And we went through the stats. And, but you need the enforcer. You need somebody who's going to be the bad cop on a regular basis. You know, it's not to kick a dead horse, but you know, you just can't reprimand someone from the match. And all these years later, you know, crystal ball, Rom's a great guy, but he's playing the same way and he's stuck. You know, I mean, how do people break out of being, you know, I mean, he's great to be 150 in the world, but how do you break out of being 150 in the world? One thing that's true in most all sports is whatever your stats are, say for example, somebody scores a lot of baskets in high school basketball. They're going to score a lot of baskets in college basketball. It pretty much works that way in most sports. You know, if someone in the sport I grew up in, if someone's a goal scorer, they're a goal scorer all the way through. Coming another one, you know, following like I didn't get a chance to see him play, but Andy Fitzell sent this to me. You know, it's just, I'm sure there's many, it's kind of like there's different polls or, you know, what's the best university in the country or whatever, best public school in the country, but biggest forehands, MPH, JJ Wolf, number one in the world. Patrick Gibson's number two. Monfils is number three. But the way I look at it with JJ Wolf, I think he's Agassi, like the way he's hitting ground strokes. But again, you do the numbers and, you know, he's trying to hit $100 shots from a 10 cent position. And you can see where Andy's worked with his volley. But, you know, and again, I didn't see him at the Australian Open, but he's not the combination, you know, where, you know, tic-tac-toe. Can you play red zone? If you play red zone, you're going to get some balls in the yellow zone. You play balls in the yellow zone. Can you play balls in the green zone? Coming back to watching televised matches, you know, it's amazing, you know, with Joey Johnson, Spencer Johnson, it's like, you know, all these matches are televised. It's like this upcoming weekend is the indoors. And I was talking to Octavio Garcia today, whose son's a very good player. His youngest son, Jose, is being recruited by all these top schools. And I said, gee, it would be great to, you know, go and just go to indoors and watch the teams that you're considering, you know, going to. He's got it down to a few schools. And Octavio goes, well, you can't do that. You know, my idea is a little bit too late. You know, I'm telling him on a Wednesday and it's this weekend. But he goes, no, we can watch it. It's not the same, but because we can watch it online. It's really public. It's really open domain to watch matches now. Junior should just realize that. I think we need to move to the men's match, though. One last thing on juniors, just going fast here, is in talking to Sophia Patel, she told me about Abby Forbes, a kid that I worked with a little bit. Did some video work with, just told me about her brother, Matthew. I watched him play, and man, talk the word tier, the word talent. T-Rex has never used the word talent, but I mean, that guy has got, he's a Ferrari. He needs some high level coaching, because he's got big time possibilities. Go ahead, guys. The men's match.
Andres, did you wake up for that one?
I got, I was in there about the second set. So you guys can start here off the first set and a half, and then I'll chime in.
First set and a half. Well, everyone knows it was two sets up for Medvedev, and then Sinner came back, and I just feel like most people feel Medvedev just ran out of gas. I got notes here saying the time disparity. This time disparity on court. Medvedev had a record, I think. He set a record. Most amount of time on court in a major, I think it was 24 hours total. And Sinner, I don't know for sure, it was like 16, but it was significantly less. And even with the disparity in that, Medvedev came out and just gave it to him. I mean, Medvedev played the first two sets, I mean, I just was cheering for him till the very end. I mean, I came into the final pretty indifferent. I wasn't really rooting for either one. Just wanted to see a good five setter. But the way Medvedev handled himself, the way he played, where I was just rooting for him. I really wanted to see him pull it out. So that was one thing, the time disparity on court. Few other things. His court positioning, his interviews are always the best. And he had an interview on court where, I don't remember who the interviewee was or the interviewer was, but
Jim Courier.
Yes. Yes. So you know what I'm talking about. He says, well, I stand back here for these reasons. And then the very next match, it wasn't the final. He stood, I was against Zverev, he stood like right next to the baseline or a couple feet back from the baseline. And in the final here against Sinner, I mean, it was a question, where is he going to stand? And he stood close for at least the first two, even three sets. And then he, I feel like reverted back towards the end, the latter parts of the fourth and fifth set. And he was going way back and almost as a desperation, but I mean, those first two sets were amazing from him. He was coming forward. He was hitting two first serves. Really. In my opinion, he doesn't really have a second serve. He just goes for it on both of them. But he's going in. His volleys are a lot better. They're a lot more linear. He does not swinging down as much on them. It's amazing a guy that's 6'6" can move that well. I mean, side to side, forward, back. He just gets everything. He's just a player. He's a gamer. He's a competitor. I mean, so many adjectives and you can give to him. He's a great person to watch.
Let's back up a little bit. I appreciate that input. Why don't you roll out some stats on Djokovic's service percentage playing against Sinner, the first two sets. While you're doing that, Jannik Sinner and Medvedev. Yeah, Medvedev, miles on the legs. We say it all the time in these podcasts. Junior should go to YouTube, listen to his interviews. So honest. My volleys are awful, but they're getting better. I have no idea how to play on clay, but I'm getting better. I'm improving. I actually just won the Rome tournament. He goes, but you know I'm going to show up and I'm going to compete. I mean, great perspective. That guy, he just runs and runs. He's like a David Ferrer, Jimmy Connors, just runs and runs and runs. And I just love how he's just so honest. Sinner's courtside speech when he won, you know, I had many people say, because he said, hey, I wish everybody in the world had my parents. It's such a nice thing to say. And he said, well, my parents gave me freedom and there was no pressure. You know, I was on a conference call today with seven people talking to a junior. And, you know, in the end, I'd like to say pressure is self-inflicted. With, you know, Sinner to me, if I made one tennis comment, you know, it was he hit one backhand volley. And he didn't hit it too well. You know, it's amazing that as great as he is, and you're talking about improving, and we'll be, you know, we're up there in section F eating a hot dog, and so let's see if he improves his backhand volley, because then you'll just have more options. But one thing he said in that victory speech, Dom Lusick mentioned this to me, who's been a guest in her podcast, has his PhD in sports psychology. He likes to dance in the pressure of the storm. I like to dance in the pressure of the storm. He said that, he chose tennis over snow skiing. People know that he was a national junior champion in Italy. And he said, I like the fact that the competition lasts longer. Another thing on center, I think he's an ISTP. Joel Trucker agreed with that on a previous podcast. Andy Fitzell said he was talking to Jeremy Niednagel, John's son, that he's an ENTP. It's amazing how many players are ENTPs as well. But center, class act, Medvedev, class act. Talks about Djokovic's numbers.
Yeah, so first serve on the serve. First set, Djokovic's first serve percentage was 43%, and his win percentage off his first serve is 44%, opposed to Sinner's, which was 64 first serve percentage, and 56 of those he won. And then in the second set, Djokovic managed to pick it back up to 75% first serve percentage, and 79 of those he won. And Sinner did a little better on his win percentage with 92 and dropped a little bit on his first serve percentage at 62. So not a very good serving first set for Djokovic.
Yeah, I think we saw a very typical scenario where Sinner was at his best, Djokovic was at his worst in that match. I think it was the point that Yvonne mentioned, the ability to adapt, to adjust, where Medvedev was playing in close. And then he even at one point went back again. What else on that match?
Well, I always like to, with Medvedev, bring up the story of when he was younger, when he was getting into the tour, where people wrote him off for quite some time because of his abnormal back problems. And I'm sure you can search up on YouTube, and there's a YouTube video on this, or multiple at least, that talk about his story, where he just couldn't move. He had back, like this specific type of back problem that he went to doctors and they just couldn't seem to find a fix for it. And he either someone reached out to him, or he finally found somebody that devised and created these specific training equipments that would strengthen parts of his lower back that allowed him to play. And just another story of, I'll prove you guys wrong, where adversity and he just overpowered. He just pushed through it. And that's a great story. I always like to bring that up when we talk about Medvedev. A couple more things on Medvedev. Like I said, I became a huge fan. If I already wasn't a huge fan, he doesn't look like he's hits the ball too hard. He doesn't look like he's exerting much energy. It looks like the harder you hit back at him, the harder it comes back. Just he's using your pace. He plays directionals unbelievably well. Like he rarely changes the direction of the ball. And it makes Sinner run more. And so I feel like with the on-court time disparity wasn't at play, he would have taken that third set and it would have been a 30-set match, because Sinner was just getting gassed. Sinner was changing the direction of the ball way too much. Like he was going line off of Medvedev's cross-court shots behind the baseline way too much. And Sinner was just running back and forth. And those first two sets were amazing. And then Sinner, you can see the stats kind of go slowly, keep on every set, go slowly down and down and down for Medvedev. And Sinner just held it and held it and held it and managed to just wait him out, in my opinion. Andres, you said you picked it up after the second set. Did you see that Medvedev's stats and Medvedev's movement and pace and return position kind of just faded after a while?
I mean, yeah, he obviously got tired at the end, but I mean, the one, I forgot what the score, I don't know if it was 4-all, 30 all, but I want to say he missed the forehand at that point, and you kind of tell like he almost could sense the finish line. And yeah, it's unfortunate, you know, it's now the second time that he's lost in the Australian Open final, being down, being up 2 sets to love. And I remember the one against Nadal, I think he was up, I want to say love 40, up 2 sets to love, love, you know, love 40 on Nadal serve, and
yeah,
lost that.
Yeah, so. A breakup and love 40, yeah.
Right.
I got
and then.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, the fact checker, I was just going to ask, when what was the finals score with Nadal and Medvedev and the U.S. Open final?
No, I remember that was a great match. I don't remember the exact score.
I'm going to guess it was a tiebreaker in the fifth?
No, it was for Nadal, 7-5, 6-3, 5-7, 4-6,
6-4. 6-4 in the fifth?
6-4 in the fifth.
Yeah, so we're we've been in a situation where we've been housing players. And I think I'm close on this one, but I think it was 4-4 in the fifth. And one of the young guys just said, "Hey, Coach Steve, can I go take a shower?" I looked at him and said, "Yeah, go ahead." I just could not believe that with but I think one thing about Medvedev, no complaints, no excuses. I mean, that's a great slogan for a back of a t-shirt. You know, he did have miles on his legs, but you know, he wasn't complaining. No, he wasn't complaining. I would love to see him win more than one. I just think it's so bad where these, to win one is so remarkable, but then these journalists, they need to be hit over the head with a bat where they call somebody a one slam wonder. I mean, it's terrible. Like, say Andy Roddick, was he in the Wimbledon final 3 times? And yeah. So, you know, that's so bad when some journalist is always a one slam wonder. I mean, get the baseball bat out. You know, I think Roger Federer said it so well, is that if you get to the quarters, you've had a great tournament. And, you know, he also says that they shouldn't double the points and double the money, and way too much hype. I want to ask you a question about hype, Andres. I've got a couple other things here to end on with, but you said to me in a conversation, Alcaraz, you know, people just like, well, he's the best, you know, young player in the history of the game. And you said, well,
the best teenager. I remember they said the most complete player for 19. And I always kind of thought that Becker was like, probably the most complete player that I had seen. Yeah. I mean, it's just recency bias. I mean, everybody has like, yeah, there's one reason we haven't mentioned it, but one of the highlights for me in the Australian Open was actually listening to Kyrgios. I actually like listening to Kyrgios in the commentary booth. I feel like he says things that are very intelligent, and people assume him to be a stupid tennis player, and he's far from it. He's borderline genius in the way he can visualize, and he's very frank. I love the references that he talked about, you know, saying how he dominated Medvedev in juniors, you know, just to show the progress that Medvedev has made over the years. I mean, I had never heard the story that Yvonne was talking about his back, but, I mean, that's incredible. But, you know, it's just amazing how people just don't really know much about tennis beyond the last 15 years, but those are the only ones you hear about, right? So.
Yeah, the greatest of all time. And, you know, tennis history has so many complexities what Connors played the Australian Open twice, Borg played it once. I mean, the fact checker, you'll get that out. But with, you know, Laver didn't play majors, as I mentioned, between 62 and 69. But I just held up this piece of paper. The last thing I have saved is I love listening to Kyrgios, the commentator. I know he's got a series coming up. He's honest. I mean, he's, but in one sense, he's similar to the rest. I mean, I really loved hearing him. And when Djokovic used to come out and blow kisses in 4 different directions, and Kyrgios said, "Yeah, that's so Bush League. That's so cheesy." And, you know, they were at, Djokovic was, not too happy with Kyrgios over comments he made, but they certainly have bonded, I guess, since having played in the Wimbledon final and what have you. But in one sense, curios. It's typical though, but there's really no nuts and bolts. I also like listening to Wally Masur, because, you know, he did talk about old school, and I don't, you know, talking about, you know, what about coming to the net, you know, doubles and such. And I had a chance to make a video for Wally many years ago. I believe he got to the quarters of every major. Gavin Hopper was traveling with them, and there was some discussion about, you know, it was approved actually for Gavin to be doing some fitness with this academy. Dave Anderson and I were running it, short-lived, but it was Seguzo Bassett, and, you know, now it's Chris Everett's. But all the way to the top, I mean, what a remarkable experience for me was when Vic Braid made a tape, an instructional tape, and you can find it on YouTube. He makes an instructional tape with Stan Smith and Arthur Ashe, two champions, Wimbledon, U.S. Open. And both those fine gentlemen, there were so many times they just said, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And I think I mentioned it before, an Aussie, Ray Ruffles, young girl I worked with, you know, he was with the USTA, and she'd gone back and forth. And I finally sent a tape to him. But at that time, you know, he looked at it and, you know, he was like, whoa, you know, he just knew the rationale was there, but he was on his way back to Australia. But with Charlie Hollis, who coached Rod Laver, and then you think of Harry Hopman, you know, the old Aussie way. I know that Kyrgios, you know, I think he certainly has grown up. I mean, where, you know, I think it was Ken Rosewall, who's not on social media, but relayed a message through social media, talking, you know, and the comment was to young Nick Kyrgios, you know, he needed to behave himself and he needed to behave like the old Aussies. And then, you know, Kyrgios just came back and it was F you, Kenny. And I know he's really, he does a lot for young people. He's really, I think he's certainly grown up before our eyes. And it is true with all these people that they're under the microscope. But no, Pecci does a great job too. Mark Pecci, I mean, just his voice alone. We Americans like to listen to the Brits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I enjoyed listening to Kyrgios and also Wally Masur, because Wally was, I think, more so than most, he's a storyteller, but it seemed like he was doing all these matches. You know, the thing is that a lot of these guys have not really been with a Vic Braden. There are not too many Vic Bradens, you know, the late Braden. Yeah, the story with Wally Masur is he was training, and I mean, I learned this from Vic. You treat the famous like they're not, and those that are not like they are. And, you know, I was in charge and said, okay, when you guys want to practice? And I said, okay, I'm going to put you on this court. You know, there's a lot of shade. And it was Amos Mansdorf and Wally Masur. And it's okay, you guys are it's great a privilege for you to be here. And we're going to have the juniors, you know, they're not going to interfere with your practice, but they're going to have lunch watching you. And, you know, it's just so I think it was daily that he was knocking off a 505 mile. I mean, these guys were really super fit, and it was right before the US Open and they were down in Florida because of the heat. And Gavin Hopper said to me, what do you think of Wally's forehand? That's how I ended up making a video. And I said, well, I looked at it and wasn't really paying attention and looked at it, you know, one, two hits. I had too bad. He has a slight reset. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, takes the racket low, takes it back up high. It's like a rocking chair. And it's not wrong, but he's taking it high. He's taking it low, high, low. He's taking it low twice. And if you could just have him, you know, say turn like a volley and just circle it. You know, it's not, you don't have to get any, you know, long dissertation. But Gavin looked at that, and, you know, certainly he was a fitness specialist, but overnight, you know, that happens in tennis. You're a fitness specialist. The next thing you know, you're talking about forehands and backhands. And Freudian slip, he looks at it, and he'd been traveling for 3.5 years. He looks at it and he goes, oh. He does. And that's a story I think that ties in with commentating. And, you know, I think your tennis would be better if it was just a major doses of honesty. And, you know, like say with Andy Roddick on serves, you know, if All you have to do really is go to YouTube and watch pros explain strokes that, you know, they get caught in some corporate outing and they got to talk about forehands and backhands. And Tracy Austin's excellent at it, you know, in comparison. I mean, she's, to me, but that's just not what they do. That's not what they do. It's like asking the saxophone player at the concert, hey, how do you play that instrument? They go, I don't know. I've been hanging on this thing forever and I don't really know. I'm not going to explain, but no, again, with the Australian Open, dollar short and a day late talking about it. It would be fun to be more current. That's where we need to raise some money so we can do that. Be more on the spot with getting out tennis content. Let's wrap it up, guys. What do you got from California, from Florida, coast to coast?
I do have a few closing comments on Sinner. Seeing things I heard throughout the final. Grew up playing soccer and skiing. Everyone knows the skiing aspect of it. I didn't know the soccer aspect of it myself. When he was down in the first set and then in an early break in the second, he looked at his box and they caught the mic off the box. And the box was basically saying, play more aggressive. Brad Gilbert, after the first set, he says he needs to start bombing the ball. Just things I picked up that were interesting to me. Both players have reset backhands, both Sinner and Medvedev. They take it low, high, low. Sinner stays down in his backhand pretty much every time. He does not lift, which is surprising to me. Because you can look up old videos of Sinner playing when he was 15, 14. And he does not, he lifts on his backhand and he doesn't have a reset. So that changed somewhere along the line where he goes low, high, low, and he stays down.
No, I think that it was Andy Fitzell recently told me that, he had a high backswing. Now he has a low backswing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Small change, but it's a big change. Interesting to me as well. One thing from a recent, we had a Canadian player here recently and we were doing some fitness drills and a very popular fitness drill is 17, run 17 lines, double sideline, double sideline, you time it. And anything under 50 is good. Anything under 45 is great seconds. And I noticed that he would always turn on his right foot or he's a lefty, he'd turn us on his left foot and he'd slide and he'd slide on his left, slide on his left, slide on his left. And if you're going back and forth like that, it's always better to alternate legs so you don't get tired out in one leg. So you go slide on your right, slide on your left. And he mentioned how he has a very tough time and it's almost impossible for him to slide on his other foot, on his right foot. And he mentioned how Sinner can slide on both feet and on hard court as well. And I never noticed that. And I just thought that was very interesting where, you know, I asked him, really, like, can you try and slide like right now on your right foot? And you just couldn't. And just never did as a child. And I guess he just hasn't practiced it, hasn't developed it, but Sinner does do it on both sides. You can see it in many of the rallies that Medvedev push him side to side, side to side. Sinner would be sliding into his backhand and his forehand.
One thing on sliding, first of all, growing up on a pair of skis, playing on red clay, playing soccer where you got to use right foot, left foot if you're good. On the brain typing, whether he's an ISTP or ENTP, he's down as a P. Our Canadian friend is a big J. And J's learn out of routine, where P's can learn out of spontaneity. And but also, if you're from the Great White North and you're playing indoor tennis 8 months out of the year, it's just remarkable to see the European players. South Americans as well, but the European players are ruling tennis and they can slide on hard court. But you know, the guy's a gamer. I mean, I think that with, you know, Mickelson, who we've talked about in length, he's a gamer. Sinner's a gamer. You know, they just love to compete. And they're certainly at two different levels right now. Young California's up to 73 in the world. And I think all you can ask anybody to do is stay connected to the great game, working with a young player who sent to us, really for us to take the role of a pre-academy So then the player can go to the academy where we train the coaches. And then when people find out they've had a late start and a bad start, but it doesn't matter. You know, tennis is a lifetime sport. You know, Braden, you know, you're 15 years old and you got 75 years to get ready for the 90 and overs. But one thing with, you know, players visiting, you know, here recently during the Australian Open. And again, I don't want to be doom and gloom, but, you know, it sounds negative, but it's just being honest. It's amazed how players who play the game, aspire to be great players, they don't take it in. They're not really tuned in to what's going on in the Australian Open. I mean, to me, I don't want to miss a match. I mean, I'd like to watch a match live. If I don't really want to, you know, watch it taped late, even if I don't know who's won the match. Anything else, guys? What do you got there? Miami Beach.
Well, the last one is, it's funny. The thing that came to my mind actually while watching Sinner was thinking of the podcast you did with Raven and wondering how, I mean, I kind of think that Sinner would struggle playing with gut strings. I was kind of wondering, like, with some of these shots that he was hitting, if he was really benefiting from the Copalis almost more than most. I mean, just some of them just absolutely slugging. It made me wonder, you know, I know people like to talk about the rackets and stuff, but I mean, to me, I think the strings make the biggest difference. And I remember Raven mentioning that a lot of these guys can, with the Alu Power or what have you, whatever Copali they use, RPM or what have you, you know, they can almost slug the ball as hard as they can and it won't go out. So that was the one thing that to me was kind of, that I kept thinking about, but it was obviously, well deserved. The guy lost possibly the biggest heartbreak of a tennis match back in, what was it, 2022 with Alcaraz at the Open. So good to see the guy finally get one.
With, I guess on my end, we could end with Jesse Pegula, who we started with. I know how to get a message to her. Do it through the Krychek family. Austin's played mixed doubles with her, but you mentioned Raven Glasson. He's retired now, and I know I could help her with a serve in a very short period of time. Now I'm sounding like Andy Roddick. I'm pretty sure I have a little more information than Andy Roddick from a technical standpoint. But he's going to tell me to go sit in Section F and, you know, get two hot dogs. But Klassen is retired, and I think he'd possibly be typecast. Well, he's a double specialist, but you know that young lady Pegula. I mean, she has a very solid game. I mean, what, she's been four in the world or higher than that, better, number one American. I like it when Federer was asked. There was a lot of hype where Lendl was. It didn't last long, but Lendl was going to coach Zverev. Zverev one time said, "My father gave me a great base." Well, thank you for the plug there. But Zverev, everybody's all excited. What's Lendl? What's going to happen with Zverev? And Lendl goes, "Well, you know, I really don't know Ivan very well."
Federer said this, right?
Federer said, "I don't really know Ivan." Thinks, "I don't really know Ivan very well, but he's already four in the world." I mean, it's amazing. You know, it's like Gilbert, certainly hats off to helping out and whatever Darren Cahill's done for Sinner, but that's that. You know, third base, they're about to score. Maybe they've already scored. And actually, I know that Cahill, in listening to the interview, is very gracious to all the people who have helped Sinner. You know, I think he's obviously a man's man and what have you, but it's not Darren Cahill or Brad Gilbert. It's the media. It's the hype. That's how I would end it, is that, you know, but again, congratulations to David Witt. I do think that people in all of sports, her father and mother, but they own the Buffalo Bills and they own the Buffalo Sabres. And you hear that all the time in pro sports, is that you do certainly can use a new messenger, but on the developmental side, especially, most of the time you don't need a new message. You just need a new messenger. And I know in my line of work, our line of work is, It's great if you can have a Pied Piper and, you know, someone who's really upbeat and positive helping you deliver the message. I always say, you know, I know a lot of coaches that are ultra positive, but they don't know technique. I mean, if you're, you know, say we talked about the great effort for the girl from China to get to the finals, and you can't turn the clock back, but, you know, you can work within. But her serve, I mean, it just, but you hear all these, you know, throughout the finals, and it wasn't a long, long match, but the commentary made on the finals is, you know, Lendl is someone who says that, you know, I don't do technique, but they do, they'll be out of line. You know, I guess two levels of ignorance. If you don't know, you don't know, but Australian Open, I hope our listeners got something out of our chit chat. Started with current events, and then we went back, covered a little bit of the Australian Open. Andres, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Andres.
All righty, guys. Well, it's always a pleasure. Always fun to spend an evening with you guys. But
you as well.
Talk soon.
Yeah, yeah. You on your way to South America?
I am. I'm going to go head out to watch the Buenos Aires Open.
That sounds like fun.
I'm waiting for Steve to tag along with me.
I need to go. With no, thanks for the invite. I need to do that. We're up here, Wintergreen in the mountains, and we figured we stay here 1 year to figure it out. But we pretty low on the responsibility side, so we can certainly do traveling. We just have a nice place to host guests and place to, for players to stay, coaches to stay. But Yvonne, thank you as well. Podcast 183 in the books. I hope there was some thoughts that will help people out.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Sorry.
Thanks for listening.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Adios. Thanks, Yvonne. Thanks, Andres.
Adios.
Thanks, listeners.